you know, the kid, at the behest of his grandfather, accepts the bet, and they go out for $2, which back in 1910 time is probably like tens of dollars.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very funny nowadays reading this book and being like, wow, we made a whole 15 cents off of this raccoon hide. That's enough to feed us for a week. And I'm like, oh,
wow,
shit.
Inflation's a bitch.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, being an adult living on your own now, like $15 is like a meal, maybe.
Hello, my beautiful listeners, and welcome back to Reginald's Book Club, which is yet to star Reginald, and what do you know, he's not here again. And in fact, this time I have no idea where he is. Lucas, that was on me, Dom.
You know, I was so excited to get to... I ran into Reginald the other night, and we were out drinking way too late. And he, let me tell you, that guy, he goes just as hard as I do when it comes to the hooch. And... I don't think I expect him to bounce back anytime soon. Unlike me, who is an unstoppable force of partying.
Yeah, no, I've seen you kick back like half a bottle of whiskey every D&D night.
Does this joke land if your audience knows I don't drink? Doesn't know that? I don't know if that joke lands.
If not doing in-jokes as a rule here, I'd never speak in this damn podcast, so we're good.
That's fair. Yeah, but, that's fair. But also,
I mean, Reginald can't hold his liquor anyway, because canonically he's a clone.
We were still out drinking. It's just I was drinking non-alcoholics, and he was going really hard in the paint. Because I don't know if he knew I didn't drink, so he was like, man, this guy's just throwing him back. And I was like,
you're just sipping lemonade.
And I'm just like, yeah, I'm so refreshed right now. Are you kidding me?
Okay, well, then the answer this month is Reginald is probably dead, so we'll have to deal with that going forward. But, thankfully, this month we're okay, because we have a special guest star. Everyone please welcome Lucas, the star of the hit podcast D-Com-E-D.
Nope.
Yep, pretty sure. D-Comedy.
No, there you got it. The way you said it the first time made it sound like a different word.
I have no idea what you mean.
Like, there was a U in place of where an O should go, and I was like, that's not our brand.
It's a British spelling thing, don't worry about it.
Ah, that's fair. I can't call you out on that one.
Yeah. But tell me a little bit, before we go any further, tell me a little bit about D-Comedy. D-Comedy.
Thank you. No, D-Comedy is a show me and my sister do. My sister, she works for BuzzFeed. She's a very funny lady. I am not quite as funny as her. I think our audience has proven that. But yeah, me and my sister, I've endeavored to watch every single Disney Channel original movie 1 month at a time. There are about 110 of them, some more as they've been coming out. And it's quite a just real peaks and valleys in terms of quality. Obviously, we haven't seen all of them before, but we grew up on these movies, so we just love going back to children's media as adults and being like, wow, people came up with this, huh? People came up with this and then put this on the air for children to enjoy, and we ate it up. And to some extent, we still eat it up, but we have a good time over there. Yeah, it comes out every month, so you should check it out if you're interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah, if you like seeing two masochists subject themselves to the worst movies that have ever existed.
There are worse movies than some of the Disney Channel original movies. I'm not saying that the low end of DCOMs is definitely maybe in that milieu, but there are worse movies than like some of the better DCOMs, I think is fair to say.
I get you. I could have sworn you just said DCOM as well, but that's maybe just be my...
Well, if so, if that did happen, it's you've incepted me now into... Ha.
Following your British aphorism.
But just
for clarity, it is D-C-O-M-E-D-Y, and it's available on, I'm assuming, Spotify, Google Podcasts, well, that's still a thing.
Yeah, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, pretty much all that jazz. Wherever fine podcasts are sold. Or if you'd like to get it direct from the source, you can go to audioentropy.com.
Where
there are plenty of great podcasts. But yeah, it's just comedy with the word D in front of it, which in retrospect was a massive mistake because it makes our SEO a nightmare.
Well, as someone who previously also poorly chose a channel name, I can relate. Anyway, we are here today to talk about Lucas's choice of books, which is Where the Red Fern Grows, which is a 1961 children's novel by Wilson Walls.
Yeah.
The back of the book unfortunately starts with a loving threesome. That's the first part of the blurb. And despite that, it wasn't what I was expecting. It's actually a young boy and his two adorable dogs who go off, they're hunting dogs and they go off on adventures. That's the general pitch. Now, usually at the start of this podcast, I say to my guests, so, you know, why did you pick this? What does it mean to you? But I think the more relevant question in this case is, why was it so important to you that I hate you?
I figured that's what... I was very interested to hear your take on it more than, like, mm-hmm. they can hear my take on it. I mean, to be fair, when I said that I wanted to do this book, you were like... I followed it up immediately with, it's very sad. And you didn't really seem fazed by that. I want to play.
You know what? I'm gonna level with you. I don't remember you. I was not listening.
That's that. You know, because the thing is, we were with friends, and you were talking about this with them, and then I said, "Oh, I know the book. I'd like to talk about Where the Red Fern Grows." And I think you went to write it down, and then I followed that up immediately with, "It's very sad." And then someone else in our group who had also read the book was like, "Oh yeah, for sure." But you were just completely like, "Oh, I gotta write that down for later." Yeah. Kind of a thing.
With the ADHD focusing, if I'm not like making eye contact, there's only a 50-50 chance I took something, any of that in. Mm. So yeah, bit sad.
It's a bit sad. Mm-hmm. I guess we should say upfront, content warning if you don't like discussions of animal death and pain.
And animal abuse.
Animal abuse.
Any bad thing that can happen to an animal happened in
this
book.
Yes, I think...
I cried myself to sleep two nights in a row.
Did you really cry?
I cried like a baby.
So did I the first time I read it. It's a very sad story.
It is. So, yes, it is. It's like, I don't know, it's like Old Yeller times two, because there's two fucking dogs who die. Spoilers,
yeah,
by the way.
That's the other thing, is that we can't really talk about this without talking about the ending, because it's kind of what it's known for and where the title comes from. I guess also when we're getting content warnings out of the way, this is a minor one, but this was written by a dude in the 60s, and it features a lot of stuff about Native Americans.
It does. It also, his main job is a raccoon hunter, and not mm-hmm. once does he ever say the rack part.
Yeah.
He abbreviates it to a word that is now a racial slur, so what are you going to call them, raccoons, personally? But
to be fair to Wilson Rawls, he actually is, this is based on his life, it's not a direct translation, but he is of Cherokee descent. Like, his mom, they lived on a farm that they got from the government, like their allotment of land, based on the research I've done, I found that to be true. But it's not, like, intensely bad, but there was some stuff where I was like, there's some stuff in it you're like, it's not gonna age well, just naturally. 1960s by it's never gonna age well.
Yes, it doesn't seem malicious. Like, there's no,
no.
I mean, there is some misogyny and stuff, because the kid often refers to the women folk, but it's...
I don't know if there are any named female characters other than the dog.
Because I was like, he kept saying, my mother, my sister, the littlest sister, the oldest mm-hmm. sister. I was like, do these people not have names? Like,
they really don't. It's mom, it's mama, papa, and then the little sister, the three different ages of sisters.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, he doesn't say his own name all that often either.
Correct.
So I mostly thought of him as the war criminal because of the horrible things that this little shit does in this book.
Yeah.
But you're probably aware of what I'm talking about, because I live text you while I was reading it.
Yeah,
which
I had forgotten about, that this was, because I thought you were, but I saw, I got a very, in all caps, text from Dom. I was like, oh, Peep's gotten to the sad stuff.
I was on chapter one, motherfucker!
I was like, oh, he's gotten to the meat of it, you know, the really stuff that gets to you. But then he was like, how could you make me read a book where a cat gets hurt? And I was like, oh yeah, he does hurt a cat a bunch of times by mistake.
Yeah. And look,
he doesn't need to hurt the cat.
I think it's the way the book treated the cat abuse, because the, you know, Mr. Rawls is very clearly a dog person, and the cat getting repeatedly injured is treated as a humorous footnote.
Okay,
I mean, again, spoilers for the end. At the very end of the book, they move out from their home and move to town, and for, you know, they live on this little house in the middle of the woods, or, you know, but they move into a bigger city. Which state is this? I can never
remember. Oklahoma. Where the wind comes sweeping over the plains.
Gotcha. So they... sorry, whispers eviscerating my other chair.
Do better, whisper. Destroy his things.
Anyway, they leave home, and then as they're walking up the hill, they look back and they go, oh, wait, we forgot the cat. And no one fucking reacts. Like, it's like that scene in that Simpsons holiday special where they drive up to the Overlook Hotel, like, three times. And then the last scene, they're like, oh, wait, we forgot Grandpa! And no one reacts. It's like, what about Grandpa? And it's like that. Like, they just left the cat behind!
It was a different time. It was a different time back then. They didn't care about animals as much as we did now. Also, it was like an outdoor cat. It's gonna be fine, you know.
Well, he became an outdoor cat because he kept getting abused.
Okay, again, abuse implies malicious intent. He just kept getting caught in his traps. That's all that happened.
Billy Coleman, the protagonist of this story, is from a very early age. From the age of 10, he wants to be a hunter. And when he's 10, they can't afford to get him the hunting dogs he so dearly desires. So they get him these little bear traps, these little baby bear traps.
Yeah, well, it's for skunk-sized animals, basically.
Yeah, so they do slam clothes painfully on creatures. And he keeps accidentally trapping the house cat. And the cat is getting more and more injured. And he keeps getting different feet trapped in it over and over again. And eventually this house cat goes feral and only comes in to eat and then leaves again. And I the rage that boiled within me with this very casual cat abuse was...
Again, abuse implies that he's trying to hurt the cat. It's sad that this kept happening to the cat.
Malicious incompetence is what I believe I text you all in caps.
He's 10 years old. Of course he's incompetent. Who wasn't incompetent at 10?
I was once a 10-year-old with very little... IQ, and I never once hurt a cat repeatedly.
Well, that's because you weren't a hunter in Oklahoma like I was, you know, and I didn't. to go back to your earlier question about why I connect with this book. And at the
I asked you why you wanted me to hate you, but let's pretend I asked you why.
Correct. I mean, I knew you wouldn't enjoy it when I picked this, and that was part of the joke. So part of the reason why this book means something to me is because, well, I had to read it for school, which I think is a very common school read book for in America for people in my age group. I think a lot of people have had to read this as part of their English classes. Maybe specifically for me too, because I went to 12 years of Catholic school, and there is a very light religious undertone to everything that goes on throughout the book.
He constantly talks to God.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's not like... it doesn't come off as, like, preachy. It just comes off to me... Like, to me, even as an adult, it reads more in a way of, like, how a child understands religion, where it's, like, if you work hard and talk to God, you'll get what you want, when it's, like, that's not really... That's my perspective on it.
We clearly have different levels of preachy, because I thought this shit was preachy as fuck.
It might also be that it's not, like, a specific, I don't know, denomination of Christianity. Like, they never, like, go to church or whatever. It's just that
it's
almost like the
gives
Protestant
God credit for his own achievements. That's what bothered me.
He worked
his ass off for 2 years to buy these dogs.
It's like the Protestant
work
ethic.
God answered my prayers.
Yeah, it's the Protestant work ethic. It's like if I work hard enough, God will give me what I want, kind of a thing. Like, that's what I'm saying. But to me, it reads more as like... That's what I'm saying, is like the way a kid understands religion and God. It's like, if you do all the good things, you get to go to heaven or whatever, and God will help you out if you talk to him and whatnot. Like, it's a very base level kind of a thing, to me at least. I think everyone could read it. Like, your mileage is going to vary in that regard. And again, I probably have a different metric because of the 12 years of Catholic school. But,
Indoctrination will do that.
When I was growing up in, I'm not from Oklahoma, that was a joke. I'm from Illinois, I'm from the suburbs of Illinois, and my house is in a very wooded area. And so there is something about being a kid growing up around woods where you do feel like, these are like my woods, you know, like this is like, I know every rock and tree and whatnot in this area. And I, for the record, me, not an outside kid. I was very much an inside boy. So it's not like I know. So it's not like I was out fording
trails.
For context,
Lucas is one of the game masters from a D&D game I play in. So that is the context of us joking that he never leaves the house.
Well, I was also just saying the fact that I'm sitting inside recording a virtual conversation with you right now, as opposed to, you know, being outside. It was that, and then also back then and even now, I just love a good boy and his dog story. There's something about it that, like, it gets me, man. It's like, because I grew up with dogs. I am more of a cat person now, but we always had dogs around when I was a kid. And we've had many great dogs in my house. My pet dog when I was a boy, his name was Rowdy. He was the absolute sweetheart. I absolutely loved him. And that's really what grabs me about this book, is, like, I think it does an amazing job of just, like, that feel of the kid is being like, I love my dog. Like, we are best pals as much as, like, they talk about it towards the end. It's like the most pure love that you can have is between a boy and his dog, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's, and I think that's a little hyperbolic, but there's something beautiful about it to me. So I really love a good boy and his dog story, and even still now. But so even though I had never traipsed the backwoods of my home like Billy Coleman does, the woods of Oklahoma, there's something about those two factors that just really intersected for me, where I was like, ah, man, to be a young boy traipsing about the forest with your pet hounds, of course, I have known that magic, and I never have in my entire life. But
well, maybe if you'd actually done it, you know it wasn't all it's cracked up to be. Cause it sounds,
oh, I'm sure it's awful.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's, you get mud everywhere. She's like barefoot for most of this book.
Yeah,
like,
dude's got fucking feet cut to hell all the way through.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he's got to have calluses. Like, it's nobody's business. It's crazy.
I will say, like, this is a tough kid. But I mean, just for more context,
this kid could probably kick my ass. I'm gonna be honest.
I mean, he's gonna grow up to be Rambo, I'm pretty sure.
A little
bit, like book Rambo. Because I'm sorry, that I did get like baby Rambo vibes, because you know, in the original Rambo, he spent the entire time commandoing through the woods, running away from people and shit. So like, mm-hmm. yeah. But yeah, so like, so this kid, I'm gonna call him Redneck Hitler because he abused cats. Redneck Mussolini. Let's go with that one.
That's a little better, I think. I don't know. I don't want to say that's better.
Look,
actually,
he accidentally hurt a cat and didn't commit seppuku, so clearly I can never relate to him.
That's fine. I'll give you that.
Yeah. Anyway, so he's growing up. He's got his mum and his pa and him, and I believe two little sisters, an older one. No, three little sisters, and a fourth on the way by the end of the book. This kid is obsessed with getting these two hunting hounds. But his family can't afford it, so he spends 2 years picking berries and doing odd jobs and saving up the money. And finally gets the whole $50. This kid is redneck as fuck, just for context.
I mean, yeah, it's freaking Oklahoma.
As you can tell from my flawless Oklahomian accent that I'm
portraying.
Yeah,
he literally, he's a redneck for Oklahoma. Think about that. Like, it is, he's not even from, like, a town in Oklahoma. He's from the backwoods
of
Oklahoma.
Other Oklahomans make fun of him for being a crazy redneck kid when he goes into town to get these dogs.
Literally, yes. That's what happens.
But yeah, so he goes into town, gets these dogs, gets beaten up by the big town boys, saved by
sheriff. He tries to use a fire escape, which that was always weird to me as a kid.
So apparently in olden times, y'all just had
like
tube
slides
going down the sides
that
of your
were
schools.
Fire escape. Yeah, I that's the thing. I never had heard of that. I was really confused what was going on there. But he dedicates a weird amount of time to it in the book.
Yeah, but yeah, so like he sneaks off from home, walks 2 days to town, pays for these dogs with his own money, puts them in a sack with their heads sticking out, walks back, casually fends off a mountain lion. because he's this fucking Rambo kid. Yeah. And I will say, so the book actually starts with a framing device where an adult redneck Mussolini...
Billy.
An adult Billy takes care of this passing dog because it reminds him of this dog that he has as a kid who... And he just casually says, you know, the fact... You know, just remembering that a dog like this laid down his life for me really just filled me full of love. And I'm like... Oh God! So I cannot fully overstate how much stress I felt throughout this book because he cocked that particular Chekhov's gun, like knowing in this book that is nothing but heartwarming stories about this kid and his two dogs, knowing that at least one of them was going to die by the end, was so anxiety inducing for me.
So let me ask you this then. Having that in your head, were you like, when old Dan dies first, were you like, oh, there it is, that dog unfortunately dies?
Yes! And also, like, it's like, the first thing they say to him is like, well, at least you still got little Anne, his little sister dog. At least it's like, yeah, I'm so thankful I still got little Anne, thank goodness. No, motherfucker, she dies too! She dies, she fucking pat-mays out and...
Yeah. She dies of grief, which is in a way, sadder.
She drags herself to her brother's grave like John Wick's dog and just dies on it. Mm. And I'm just like, you bastard.
Yeah. It's sad, man.
Yeah, it is.
To tell you the truth, I don't know the last time I've actually read through the book all the way. Because I read through it, obviously, when I was a kid, I had to read for school, and I was like, this is a great book, I love this book. And I had reread it a couple times, but there are a lot of times, because I have it just, like, as a book on my phone, and so times I've just, like, got nothing to do, or, like, no cell service somewhere, I was like, I'll just read a little bit of Where the Red Fern Grows, and I always get through I really love the beginning where he's getting the money to buy the dogs, and then he gets the dogs from the station, and then that's a good, like, break point if you want to stop reading there. And then I've also gotten up through the competition, because the competition also slaps. I always forget. It took me a minute when I was reading over the summary and stuff, just so I remembered all the points that we were probably going to talk about. I forgot about the child death that also occurs. That does happen.
I was significantly less upset about that than I was about the cat and dogs, but that's good.
Yeah, but it's a weird interlude. It's a weird interlude. So I've read at least up to the champion, but then I think the last time I got up to the championship, I was like, and he wins the championship. And I'm like, oh, well, there's only one thing left to happen in this book, so I'm going to close the book.
The end.
The end, as far as I'm concerned.
He goes home, gives the gold and silver cups to his little sisters, and lives happily ever after for a long, long time with his perfectly healthy dogs.
Yep, who die of old age at 125.
Yeah, longest living dogs ever, science fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what love does, you know, it's beautiful. Well, let me ask you this real quick. Which was your favorite dog? Are you an old Dan Stan or an Ann Stan?
I am going to go with Little Ann, because...
That's the correct answer!
Yeah, but big old Dan is just like... multiple times, human beings almost die because he's too stubborn to give up on hunting a raccoon.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just a bit stressful. Like, he's
got a good heart, though.
Yeah, and he's the heavy hitter of the group, don't get me wrong, but like...
That's why I thought you maybe would be lean more towards the old Dan route, but no, Lil Ann rules.
The big,
best.
Dumb, hard-hitting idiot is who I always play in D&D, yeah, no, but like, yeah, no, Lil, the smarter dog was probably my favorite. But yeah, so this kid, this little war criminal gets his two dogs and starts a very successful career hunting raccoons with them. And a lot of the book is like how these dogs overcome all the quote-unquote tricks that these raccoons try, which, depending on how accurate this book is to real life, I learned a lot about raccoons, because apparently incredibly intelligent, and I'm very, very sad that they were hunted for sport and fur.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is like, we're talking about all this animal, like, abuse and death. Oh, the raccoons get murked constantly.
Yeah, and they are always talking about how smart they are, how intelligent they are, you know, how they wail with despair when they realize the jig is up.
Yeah, no, I don't know a lot about raccoon hunting other than from this book, obviously. But I know, I grew up around raccoons. We've had a ton of raccoons in, like, the woods around my house. They don't really have raccoons in, like, England, right? Like, so you wouldn't really be...
No, but we... Yeah, not nearly as common if we have them at all.
Yeah,
I've never seen one.
I don't think so. But yes, they are the incredibly smart creatures. They are very tricky. We've had to, like, try to call, like, animal control to, like, catch a raccoon, and it's always really hard. They're not just, like... They will absolutely, like... We were talking about the traps earlier. Like, the traps... could theoretically catch a raccoon, but the raccoons are too smart. They know how to, like, put a stick in there or, like, get the food, knock the food away, kind of thing. Like, they're very smart creatures.
Yeah. So, the method of hunting in this book is, you know, the dogs chase them up a tree, the kid either chops the tree down or, like, they fire buckshot at it, and then the dogs tear the raccoon apart.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that is
so
what happens.
You know, I didn't love that, to be honest. Like, I know he was hunting for a purpose because he's selling the skins. It's not like British fox hunting where they were just doing it for sport.
Sport. Yeah, that's the thing. It is kind of more for sport than anything. Because, like, he doesn't care really about the money. He's just like, here, Dad, here's the money I made. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
It is mostly for sport. And yeah, obviously, I don't condone hunting in any way, shape, or form. Mm. Trophy hunting and shit like that. It's all stupid and dumb. And so, I'm not saying that I like this book because of the hunting. It is more about, like, the journey with the dogs. The hunting is just part of it. And to be fair to Wilson Rawls, because this is meant to be a children's book, it's not overtly, like, bloody, necessarily.
I think it's almost worse, because it sort of plays down the violence and horribleness of it. Like, you know, it will just say, and then it was over for the raccoon. Old Dan got a good hold on him and tore, you know, then... So it's like, it's almost whitewashing the violence of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair perspective.
Although the scene, the first time he catches a raccoon, when he does it with, like, a trap, and his father basically clubs it to death. That was a bit more graphic.
That was the worst one, for sure. The one where he, like, because also it has to describe, like, the trap where it's like the nails pointed down, and it's got its hand just wedged against the nails. And
I was really like, this is gonna be horrible.
The dad is even like, hey, kid, don't do this anymore. Like, because...
Yeah. He's like,
that's what he says. He's like, this is just not fair, and it's weirdly crueler than getting torn apart by a dog. Yeah.
Which is funny, because the grandpa was the one who told him about it. He was like, oh, yeah, I used to catch 5 or 6 raccoons a day with this technique. So his grandpa, that was a piece of shit.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, right? I feel like if this works, people would be doing this, because people are awful, especially in the past. So it's, like, weird to me that, like, this isn't the dominant way of raccoon hunting, is to just set these weird, painful traps.
I mean, maybe they looked...
Because it seems easier.
Yeah, I mean, the general idea... in the way it was described in the book, is that for some reason, if a raccoon wants a shiny thing, it will reach into a hole and grab it. And then if the thing is too big to pull its hand out, it just will never let go. And I don't know how true to real life that is, but...
I believe that's pretty accurate, yes. I mean, obviously, I don't know how many times a raccoon has been in such a situation, yeah. But my grandmother, this is proving that I am from a bit of a backwoods background, is my grandmother, her family had a pet raccoon when she was growing up, where, like, that, I say pet in quotes, it didn't, like, live in their house, but it, like, would live in a tree nearby and then come into the house and, like, take food and shit. And there were not exactly like that, but they talk about, like, that happening with, like, a butter churn. It, like, reaches in the butter churn and it can't get its hand out, but just doesn't let go of the butter. But she had told similar stories of stuff like that happening. It's, like, it's very hard to get a raccoon to let go of something it's grabbed onto, basically. Yeah.
I mean, it's probably not used because it's immensely cruel. I mean, there's probably some laws against animal cruelty when it comes to trapping them, right?
Yeah, but no, I'm saying now, 100%, but this is the past when people did... Animal cruelty wasn't a thing in freaking 1910 or whenever this takes place. That's what I'm saying. I feel like people in the past would have been like, yeah, who cares if the animal dies horribly? Like, we get the raccoon skin out of it. Good for us.
It was kind of funny because I am fairly consistently anti-Second Amendment, but I was thinking, like, I was actually kind of in favor of this 12-year-old boy getting a gun, just on account of it would probably be more humane for him to pop a cap in that raccoon's ass in the tree than force it to come down and get torn apart.
Well, I don't think they shoot it dead in the tree. I think the gunshot is to scare them.
Yeah, well, I'm saying it would be a lot more painless if they did shoot the raccoon in the tree.
Yeah, but I'm saying that'd be really hard. Like, to make that kind of shot?
I was imagining smaller trees. I've never been to Oklahoma, so...
No, I'm thinking more of, like, the big tree. I get what you're saying. That makes sense. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they can always see them, and they're like, the raccoon, like, sometimes tries to jump off the branch and stuff.
There is a significant portion of this book dedicated to just chopping down a big tree, for the record.
Yes.
If that doesn't interest you, listeners, then you're going to be disappointed.
The very first time he takes the dogs out hunting, the raccoon happens to climb up the biggest tree in all the forest, and he has to chop it down with a herring. Monty Python reference there.
I just didn't laugh, but I understood it.
You should have done, though. So anyway, let's try and repair the friendship later. He does spend about 2 chapters just determinedly trying to chop down this 30-foot thick tree. Because he's like, but I made a promise to my dog. I said, you
are you going to say all of his dialogue with this accent?
Absolutely. Okay. Make your peace with it.
Please continue.
I'm going to go cut that tree down because I promised my dogs that if they got the raccoon up a tree, I'd do the rest. And, like, his father turns up and is like, yeah, that's... I was going Scottish there for some reason. You're right, son. What are you doing? And he was like, I made a promise, Pa. I got to keep cutting this tree down. And I don't know. It seemed a bit wasteful of a massive tree. But
yeah, wrong. Also, I feel like it would have taken out a lot of trees on its way down if it was that big.
It does. It describes taking down a massive amount of trees.
Right, but I'm just saying. I mean, like, it would have, and then that would have been a net negative for the forest. Personally, listen, I'm not saying I'm on the kid's side on that one. But that being said, we're talking about, like, length of chapters. This movie, like I was talking about, the book is really broken up into, like, 3 kind of acts, quote unquote, where it's like the beginning where he's getting the dogs, he gets the dogs, and then it's like a big section of raccoon hunting, and which that's a part of, and then you can kind of slide the championship either into the end of that or the start of the third, which is just kind of like the conclusion, because the ending does kind of come out of nowhere, where it's just like
sudden. It's very sudden. Build up.
Yeah, yeah, he has this big victory or whatever, and then just like sometime later he goes out raccoon hunting and walks into the unfortunate situation he does. So it's like that's kind of the smallest one, or you could kind of tack the championship onto that of like the highest moment and the lowest moment if you were looking at it. But the tree chopping down part of it is not particularly exciting, I will admit.
I mean, I can't profess
what was your favorite part?
Much of the book exciting.
That's fair. But what was your favorite part of the book, would you say? Favorite part of the story?
I was probably having the nicest time when he was picking up the puppies, because puppies would be cute. And big dogs that tear apart other creatures is less cute.
Oh yeah, before it gets to the hunting, the bad, like the really bad stuff. Yeah,
basically,
that's a good pick.
Basically, we're just describing two cute puppies in a sack, you know?
Yes, excellent. I agree. That's a good pick. I would also say, that for me, or the I do really like the tournament, like the championship is a really.
I refer to it as a tournament arc as well. I was like,
it feels like a tournament arc. Feels like an anime tournament arc a little bit. It's not in any way, shape, or form, but it it has the heft.
It's very anime in that it's a 12-year-old boy taking part in a competition that's exclusively grown men everywhere else and winning.
That's true. So. Yeah, he does win. He also wins. I also love the beauty contest before the thing actually starts, because little Anne absolutely crushes it because she's the best.
We forgot to mention, the dogs are called Old Dan and Little Anne, because while he was walking home from picking up the dogs, he found someone had written, like, Dan for Anne or something on a tree.
Dan plus Anne in a heart, carved in a tree.
And he was in the same place where he'd, like, there was some, like, fisherman's camp where he'd
found
the
magazine.
Money. Yeah.
It's right about the magazine saying, with the
puppies for sale!
Yeah.
Also, this is set in 1910, so if we hadn't mentioned that already, that might explain some of the context here, like this redneck boy walking across Oklahoma or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Listen, in 1910, no one gave a shit about anything. Like, this kid, literally, he doesn't tell his family he's doing this, by the way. He just leaves to walk across the mountains, and then they come back, and he doesn't really face a lot of punishment for it.
But you know what? I kind of liked his weirdly supportive parents, because they were...
I do, too.
His mother did burst into tears occasionally when she thought he was dead, but she never gave him a hard time for it. And
she
his
did,
father
she
was
did.
Usually like...
Yeah, the dad is much chiller than the mom. The mom does. It is described multiple times that the mom does beat the son in a corporal punishment.
She gives him a switch
kind of a thing, which is an old timey term. But no, his parents are cool. I mean, the grandfather is meant to be kind of like his, you know, emotional confidant, kind of core of his whole story.
Pretty cool, yeah. But I do like that. Like, his father turns up and is like, "Hey, son, you've been missing for 2 days. Like, I'm chopping down a tree, Pa." I was like, "All right, well." Carry on.
Yep. No problem.
It was like, I'm off into the deep woods for a few days to hunt raccoons. It's like, all right, son, take care.
His dad does do the weirdest thing in the book for me, which is at the end, after the dogs die, and the dad goes...
I was going to bring this up if you didn't, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's like one of those things that, like, when as a kid, I didn't really clock it, but as an adult, it really gets to me. So your son has just lost his two best friends in the world. His dogs have died. Traumatically. I mean, it's rough for it to lose a pet in any way, shape, or form, but, like, to lose him so suddenly and violently is especially bad. And then he tells the son that, well, you know, here's the thing, Billy, is that with all the money you made from catching the raccoons, now we can afford to move to town like we've always wanted to, so you kids can get an education and have a better life. But we knew it would break your heart to move away from the woods where you can hunt with your dogs or whatever. So in a way, it's like your dogs dying was a good thing.
That's why God killed your dogs.
Yeah, basically.
Because he didn't want to split up the family. And I look, because the next bit is like, seeing that this hadn't improved, like, that this explanation hadn't lifted my spirits. Like, yeah, no shit. He basically said, God killed your dogs so you'd be able to move to town.
Like, again, he's going for the silver line, which he doesn't want to move to town, by the way. It's like, it's the weirdest thing to say to your son so immediately after the dogs have died. Like, I feel like maybe, you know, you get a couple years out in the future, you may be like, well, you know, son, if you think about it, if that hadn't happened, you wouldn't have this great life that we have now. And then he'd be like, oh, wow.
That I sometimes have come across in real life from religious people when it comes to death, in that they'll say, well, you know, it's God's will. And I'm like, well, fucking fuck God then, because, like, what the hell, man? It didn't seem that surreal to me, because I've seen people in real life say, well, you know, it happened for a reason, he died for a reason. I'm like, there's no reason to kill people.
Well, it's also just that it's like, So, that's what I'm saying. So immediately after the dog dies, for me.
Well, I mean, that's the second thing they said. The first thing, of course, was being, at least you still got the other dog. Oh, no, she's dead.
Like someone runs in from off screen. It's like, well, you still got the other dog. Well, actually, if you, you want to go up on the hill and bury the other one, I have some bad news.
Yeah. I felt kind of like angry at little Anne because I was like, yeah, she's lost her brother, but like her other best friend, you know, her human, is still needs her, but she just nopes out on life.
You know, grief. Don't judge a dog's grief, Don.
I'm gonna. No, man's a selfish bitch.
We did talk about the child death. Do we want to go in depth on that one?
We should probably explain that. Yeah. So there's another redneck family living like a couple of
that are mean.
Over. They're the rednecks that the other rednecks don't like because they're chewing tobacco at age 13 or whatever, and they're placing bets and just being awful bupkis people. And so they kind of, I believe, out of just general mischief and jealousy that this kid has like increasingly state famous hunting dogs, challenge him to find what they call the ghost raccoon,
which is a cool name.
Yep, so it's a raccoon that is very wily and runs up into trees and just disappears. So, you know, the kid, at the behest of his grandfather, accepts the bet, and they go out for $2, which back in 1910 time is probably like tens of dollars.
Yeah, no, it is. It's very funny nowadays reading this book and being like, wow, we made a whole 15 cents off of this raccoon hide. That's enough to feed us for a week. And I'm like, oh,
wow,
shit.
Inflation's a bitch.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, being an adult living on your own now, like $15 is like a meal, maybe.
So then we get 90% of the chapter is, you know, dogs versus the ghost raccoon and their the wily tricks and doubling back, and it's, you know, playing mind games and 3D chess with this. And then eventually the dogs, because these are super hunting dogs, eventually do corner the ghost raccoon in a tree. Billy decides not to harm it because he apparently has more compassion for this one wily raccoon than he does for his fucking cat.
Yeah,
because
the trick the raccoon would do, it would go up the same tree and then it would walk across a branch and then go into a big fence post that was actually hollow. So that was his trick. But of course,
all sorts of clever tricks. Again, makes me increasingly sad that all the way through this book, these intelligent creatures were being torn to shreds.
Yeah, well, he wasn't gonna kill that one. That was smart enough to live, I guess.
So he gets into a fight with these two redneck kids. Their dog turns up and tries to pick a fight. To the awful redneck distress, they find out that the two wonder dogs can also scrap really well, so they're actually beating the shit out of their dog. One of the kids grabs Billy's axe, presumably to try and stab one of his dogs, and then just straight up falls on it and kills himself.
Yeah, we were talking about, it's because we were just talking about this, I think God may have killed that kid. Because he's like, oh, he trips on a stick. And then I'm like, I was like, are we implying that they're like...
I think you're right. God iced that kid.
It felt like there was some divine intervention going on, is all I'm saying. Yeah.
God was like, okay, so either the cute dog, who I'm going to kill later anyway, but we haven't gotten that yet.
We haven't gotten there yet.
We're
not there. Yeah, we're not there yet. No.
So, yep, trips and disembowels himself.
And Billy's not that torn up about it.
He's in shock for like 12 hours.
He did hate this kid, but like I think seeing someone disemboweled with an axe, your axe specifically, I think that would do something to a lot of us, to most of us. That he's just kind of like, this is life in the Ozarks.
Yeah, what's fucked up is his grandfather goes and gets the axe, cleans it, and then gives it back to his grandsons, like, you know, this is a... I know you probably have some trauma, but this is a good ex, kid, you know?
Yeah, for murdering. That's what it's good for.
It's clearly a good ex, because it can disembowel a 10-year-old in one sleep.
It's tasted first blood.
And it's got a taste for it now. It's got a thirst. Which is not wrong, because... But anyway, we'll come back to that. But it was a very sort of loosey-goosey way of dealing with this, because like he goes home and tells his parents. His parents go and get the deceased child's parents. They carry him home, bury him the next day, and like, I mean, the grandfather held on to the axe in case the police wanted to see it, but they didn't. Everyone was just like, well, the boy's dead, bury the boy. Okay, well, we got 17 more, bury the boy.
That's what I was going to say. I guess that's just the time, you know? It's like, that's when you could get die from, like, diarrhea or cholera or some shit, yeah. You know? Like, if you could just... Yeah, you know, like, and especially, like, back, you know, in the backwoods where there's not, like, a doctor in, like, 50 miles or something, that'd probably just been like, oh, well, I got a cut on my arm, hope it doesn't get infected and I don't die, you know?
Like, it kind of sounds like the police didn't even bother interviewing any of the witnesses. Like, fed on the axe? Yep, sounds about right. Bury the boy.
I'm sure, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I feel like the police in this place are, like, one guy who is also,
it's
like...
It's the one guy who broke up a fight and bought him a popsicle, so...
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, but that's in town. That's what I'm talking about. Also a soda pop. But it's I've read this book a couple times. But it's
that, what that, it was just funny to say popsicle.
That's the main. That's the sheriff in town. I'm talking about, like, in this backwoods. I don't believe there's, like, a police department. Like, there's just, like, one dude.
The librarian,
who's, like,
who's also the fireman, is also the
That's what I'm saying. Like, one dude comes out, puts a different hat on, and is like, "Did you kill this boy, Billy?" And he goes, "No." And he's like, "All right, sounds good to me."
Fair,
and
then just.
Yep.
You want to see the axe? Nah, man, that's gross.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to see no axe.
Clean that off.
Clean that shit up. Yeah, so that's the first time Billy sees a violent death. But yes, then he goes on to the tournament arc. He's like, literally, his grandfather's like, "What the hell happened, boy?" It's like, "Oh, the kid died." It's like, "All right, well, I booked you for a cool competition. You want to talk about that instead?" And that's literally the same day. Yep. That he sees his father. It's like the next day after this kid dies.
One
it's like
other.
Tournament. So, yeah, they don't mourn for... like, this kid really... And, like, he really isn't bothered by it ever again. Like, he gets slightly triggered when he sees the axe of blood on it. But he almost... He's like... He almost felt like it was weird thinking about the boy at a time like this. It's like, it's not! It's the same axe!
I mean, I also feel like there... I mean, he puts flowers on his grave. But I feel like there is, like, an underlying thing of, like... I mean, I didn't want him to die, but that kid did suck, you know? I'm not saying I think that. I'm saying I think he was kind of like, I mean, I feel bad for you, but, like,
I mean,
you were a jerk. I don't know. I don't have time for you.
Billy is a psychotic little monster, so,
yes.
Yeah. Because he hurt a cat.
Unintentionally. But yeah, the tournament arc is pretty cool. I really like the scene where, like, it's a movie, but, like, the scene. I like the part where they, the dogs get lost in the snow and they have to find them the next day, like, and they've just been moving around in a circle, like, to keep warm, like,
oh,
all
you know what I like
long.
About that? Yeah, so there's a whole thing, the boy's doing really well. His dogs are bringing back a record number of small, innocent, slaughtered woodland critters. He makes it to, like, the third round, the first round, the fourth round, you know, final round. And then while he's out with his grandfather, his father, and a judge, a bad snowstorm hit. And so first they lose the dogs, and they go and find the dogs, and they realize they've left Grandpa behind. He's been... So they go back and find Grandpa with his legs, badly hurt, and then they go off, and then they find, like, three raccoons in one, and then the dogs run off into the snowstorm, and they can't find them. So there's all sorts of drama going on. Mm-hmm. And the next... So they have to go back to camp, and the next day... Someone comes running and is like, "I done found the dogs. They done frozen solid."
Everyone talks like this, I guess. Your version.
Well,
of this.
How are you imagining these voices?
Well, I just did. They all don't need to sound exactly the same. Is my point?
I could,
they all have the same level of southern accent.
Oh, okay. Well, say this one person was Irish. I found your wee dogs, and they were frozen solid. I don't know what. That's not even close to Irish. Anyway,
I think they get the point.
But he runs up screaming that, like, these dogs were, like, basically popsicles. And the kid faints with grief and horror. And he wakes up, and the guy's like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say they were dead. They're just really cold-looking. I'm sorry. And everyone's like, "You dick." Why would you say it like that?
Yeah, that is pretty good.
So these dogs literally have worn a trench down like a fucking cartoon walking around this tree to get this final raccoon for him to win the competition. And he goes home victorious, and that's the end of the book.
Yep.
And he's
ending on a high note.
Yep, and it's not sad at all. Then... yep.
But hey, Dom, did you get to the end of this book and were like... Man, I wonder why it's called Where the Red Fern Grows. No red ferns.
No references to red ferns whatsoever.
Yeah.
And also, someone apparently tore the last part of this book away, threw it in a shredder, and then repressed that he did that.
Sounds about right.
So, he goes back to his wonderful world of hunting, walks straight into a lion, and the dogs basically fight the lion to the death.
They tree a mountain lion, which I think is freaking crazy that they get it in a tree, for the record. That's insane to me.
So we keep saying treeing. Treeing basically means chased into a tree, for the non-hunting experts amongst us.
It's up a tree kind of a thing.
So these dumbass dogs chase a mountain lion into a tree.
Yeah. And decide, you know what? We got a shot at taking this thing out.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, this is white male on the internet confidence in these dogs. But
well, they just won the big competition, I guess.
Yeah. As soon as Billy turns up, the lion's like, "Oh my gosh, you look just like Lunch." And the leaps upon him, and you know, the dogs, being the loyal, loving creatures that they are, engage in a fight to the death with the lion. And old Yeller 2.0 is mortally wounded. In a very graphic way, it did not need to be that traumatic. Like, he is torn to shreds. Like,
the worst, it's worse for me, is the walk back.
Yes!
It's rough.
Like, he's cut, his ears are torn off, there's blood all over him. Like, he's straight up bleeding to death. The kid has to, like, pack him in earth, like, mud, to stop the bleeding. And it's like, okay, let's get you back and we can get you some actual medical attention. And on the way back, all Dan's entrails, his guts, spill out through get caught on a branch and tear out of his body. It is graphic and horrifying.
Did we put that in a content warning?
Probably not, but we did, you know, we've discussed gore.
It's rough, man. And then they have to describe that they have to, like, clean them before putting
so the
them
kid
back
gets, like, his fucking handkerchief out, and he's trying to, like, clean his guts and push them back into the body. Then he gets them home, and the mother has to pull the guts out again, wash them with soap and water, and then put them in again and sew them up. And shockingly, this does not save the dog's life. He does, in fact, die, like, 12 hours later after agony.
Yeah. It's, I mean, having your guts outside your body will do that to you.
That did not need to be as graphic as it was.
It's the most... That's what I'm saying. Fuck. That's what I was talking about, like, you know, the raccoon death. They're not terribly graphic stuff, like, but then I think he was saving it up. He's like, oh, for the end, I'm going to traumatize the children reading this book.
Yeah. Because, like, I don't know if the dog would have lived if he hadn't happened to have gotten his guts caught on a stick. But it's not impossible.
It's not impossible. I also feel like if there was any form of, you know, actual, like, veterinary care in 1910, which I'm sure there wasn't... It was just like the mom being able to be like, well, I know how to sew, so I can sew flesh together.
Yeah, I'll like, scrub his guts like I'm scrubbing the dishes.
Yeah, you know.
So the dog, you know, old Yeller Dan dies, and everyone immediately consoles him that he still has Little Anne. And then Little Anne, Padme's out of this world, and...
They literally describe, like, that she, like, won't eat, and they have to, like, pour food down her mouth and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then she gets emaciated, and then with her last strength, her back legs aren't working, with her front legs, she claws her way to her brother's recent grave and dies on it.
Mm-hmm.
It is horrific.
It is so
emotionally devastating.
And I read this at age 12.
Well, I read this at age... my headphones, sorry, I'm making too many graphic gestures. I read this at age 36 and still cried for an evening, so thank you for that.
You're welcome. You know,
I am going to be so chaotic in our next D&D game, Granny Goose Creature is going to burn things to the ground in revenge for this.
I'll give you... We're going to do a quick D&D digression, Dom. Do you want to do something fun? You know the wolves that you guys met a couple sessions ago?
Yes.
They were supposed to be bad, and you guys were supposed to kill them, but I didn't do that to you.
I mean, to be fair, Granny did bite one of them because they bit her.
Yeah, well, they were mean, but
I play a crazy
them.
Old woman in D&D.
You befriended them too hard, but I'm saying, so I didn't do that to you personally, but I did make you read a book about dog death. So I'm just saying, it all balances out.
Yeah. Appreciate that. I guess. No, I'm still mad.
I know you are. But yeah, then because God did this, I guess, they can move to town. But
that's the worst comforting ever.
That's what I'm saying. Why would you do that so soon after it dies? But because God did it, he does soften the blow somewhat, as God is wont to do, I guess, quote unquote, in that before they pack up and leave, Billy goes to the grave one last time. And he sees that a red fern has sprouted where in the graves of the dogs. I looked this up in preparation of this because I've always wondered if this is a real thing, like red ferns slash this legend.
He tells a story about these two Cherokee kids who died in a snowstorm or something, and then red ferns grew on their graves, and it's meant to be a sign of like blessing their spirits or something, right?
Yeah, it's meant to. It's basically like they died like cradling each other or something like that. Like they loved each other, so they died together, kind of a thing. They died trying to protect each other or something like that. And it's like if it's like a death that is so like sprouted from not sprouted, but like a death with such love behind it or something like that. It's like it's not, I think the actual words is like only an angel can plant the seeds of a red fern and then it'll only grow in a place that is like it's like a message about like beauty and love in the face of death, kind of a thing. And it's like kind of like a sign to Billy that it's like even though this terrible thing has happened to you, the dogs, their love is eternal and their love for you is eternal and they're in dog heaven or whatever. But that's what I'm saying. I don't know if that's a real legend or not. Like I Googled it and like everything is just seems to reference like this story or like they say like, oh, they're like, oh, there's this old legend about these Cherokee kids dying in a snowstorm. And I'm like, yeah, but that's exactly the thing that's cited in this book. So did Wilson Rawls make that up or is that
an
actual legend?
If it's going around in circles like that, it probably is an original for this book.
I don't know, but it's a beautiful ending moment, and that's why it's called Where the Red Fern Grows, because it grows on the dog's face.
I was distracted by the ending, because while talking about looking back at this beautiful red fern, that's when they mention that they didn't bother picking up the cat. And the little girl is like, we forgot, what was his name? Old Sammy.
We forgot Sammy,
and no one reacts, and they just leave without the cat. So this cat was left to fend for itself. So
man, fuck really
this entire family. Burn in hell, you pieces of shit.
Ah, cat's fine, I'm sure. Don't worry about it. For the record, like I said, I have a cat person. I'm not trying to be dismissive of what this cat goes through, but it didn't bother me as much as it bothered Dom, but I guess that's because as a kid, I just was like, yeah, you know, it's a book.
You were also a little psychopath, as all kids are want to be.
I guess, or I just didn't have media literacy. Or but I think really what it is just that it's like, because I know like when I was reading this for school, a lot of kids in my class were like real torn up about it. And I was definitely sad, obviously, but it's like I've just always been good at that separation of fiction and my emotions, I suppose. But I'm not an easy cry, to put it there. So even though I was joking about it, I didn't actually, I think, cry when I read this book.
Mm-hmm.
But it did very emotionally impact me. So I think I didn't get as much empathy for the cat as you did out the gate.
I just like cats.
I do too. I mean, the cat, well, I mean, if you think about it, the cat made it longer than the dogs, so.
Not through the roots of trying on Billy.
So, scoreboard. Fucking... Scoreboard.
So, what, how, the dogs lasted, what, 3 years, maybe?
Yeah, now, I don't know if they say. I don't know if they say how old he is by the end of it. Like, because he's 12 when he gets the dogs, because he starts at 10, works for 2 years, and then he's 12. And then he gets the dogs and he trains them. I don't know, like, so I don't know how young they are when they're trained. They're still mostly puppies.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know how long the coon. I don't know how long the raccoon hunting. You can have her change it to me saying raccoon because you're right. We should avoid that. So I don't know how long the raccoon hunting takes up. I imagine it feels. I think they say it's like a summer. I think because like by the time towards the competition, it's like. Fall, the start of winter, I feel like. So he might have had them for like a year-ish, maybe.
No, really?
That's what I'm saying.
Just past puppyhood.
I don't remember. Yeah, well, I think they are meant to be young. That's why they're very lively. I don't think he has them for that long. I think it is. He only really has one season hunting, I feel like. I might be misremembering. There might be a line where like they say like, oh, yeah, over the next couple summers or something like that. I don't remember. But I don't think it's that long of a timeline, unfortunately. But yeah, that makes it extra sad.
Right, well. Usually at this point, I'm just talking about the themes and stuff, but like, I don't mean this as a insult to the book. I think it's fairly simple. It is a simple story of a boy and his dogs, and they love each other and go out on adventures. And
I mean, I think there are certain themes of like determination and like working for what you want, kind of the Protestant Protestant work ethic stuff we were already talking about. But I do think something that like. Appealed to me as a kid when I was reading is that like I think Billy has a like a certain outlook on life where he's just like if you break up something that's hard into a bunch of small tasks and it becomes more manageable and achievable. And I think I've always had a very similar outlook on life. Or maybe not life, that's a little bit of big, but it's like, when I have to tackle something or I'm facing a difficult situation, like, it's always easier to me to think of it as, like, the small steps you have to take to get there. And it's like, eventually, if you just keep checking off those boxes, you'll get through it without even realizing it, kind of a thing. And I think that's just something that's, like, that's, I don't know if that counts as a theme, but that's something I was connected with as a kid, was, like, that idea, like, that ideology, that outlook on how you go about doing stuff, I guess.
Yeah, no, I get it. Like I said, my take on it was slightly different, because it kind of annoyed me that this kid was putting so much blood, sweat, and tears into everything he did, only for turn around and say, "God answered my prayer" at the end.
Yeah, but
you answered your prayer.
And that's what I'm saying. I think that's the difference between a Catholic school education and a normal one. Is like, work hard and you'll do it, and it's like, work hard and God helps those who help themselves.
What's God got to do?
I would be very interested, instead of going over all the themes, I would be interested to hear your like full, I think you've talked about like the animal stuff getting to you, whatever, but like, did you enjoy reading it? Like, what is your quick summary review of the book?
I think I did somewhat against my better judgment and will. I wouldn't have been emotionally affected by it if it wasn't, if the author wasn't very talented. It was. I do wish some of the stories didn't involve, even the chapters that have happy, the happy chapters involve something dying, whether it's the cat, the dogs, or the raccoons. You know, there's always some creature, but like, if you can put that aside, it is a very charming story. And I said that, everyone loves a good dog story. So
yeah, and it is very simple. You know, it's for kids, but I think its simplicity is like part of the enjoyment of it. Is it's like what you see is what you get.
Yeah, and like I said, it does. Billy, as much as he is a little horrible person who I would not pee on even if it was on fire because of the cat thing, I was impressed with just how determined he was, and how I think we could all learn a little something from him, not just when it comes to animal ethics, but in regards to his determination.
But it's funny you mentioned that it was pretty well written, because this guy Wilson Rawls, he only wrote two books as far as I could tell, which was this and another one with an amazing title that I love forever, which is Summer of the Monkeys. This is a hyper specific reference. I don't know if the audience is going to understand this, but my favorite film is Kiki's Delivery Service, and the copy I had as a child, the VHS, like the Disney one, had all of the previews. I watched it so many times, I know all the previews by heart, and one of them is for a made for TV like movie or direct to video version of Summer of the Monkeys. So I was starring Wilford Brimley. So I knew that before I knew it was written by the same guy, but it's about this kid living in like, I think the late 1800s, so a little bit before when this book takes place. And it's like these monkeys escape from a circus train and they put out a reward for their capture. And, the kid wants to do it to help pay for his sister's operation, 'cause she's got like, something wrong with her leg, I think. I don't remember off the top of my head. But those are the two books I think he's written. But it's a, that's the, I have a weird connection to the other book. That's very funny to me.
All right.
Which this did get, if you are interested, all listeners, this did get made into a movie a couple times. There's one from the 70s, which I have seen, and it's pretty,
Where the Red Fern Grows? Is that?
Where the Red Fern Grows. Yeah. Yeah. The Summer of the Monkeys, I only know of that, direct-to-video one. But there's, like, it's one from the 70s, it's this movie, that's this story. And then apparently, I just found out when I was Googling around about this, there was also one in 2003 that I have not seen. The 70s one is a very basic, like, it's the book. Like, there's not, and it's not that much to talk about. Like, I mean, obviously, you know everything about adaptation, but it's like, from my memory of watching it, I was like, yeah, they sure did just make the book into a movie, I guess. Like, I don't know what you want. I don't feel like anything's really better or worse. It's just kind of like, yeah, there you go. It's less interesting, maybe, because it feels kind of stilted, but that's just the 70s. They did a weird thing, and I do feel I need to mention it because it's so weird. Is they made a sequel to that movie that is not based on anything, because there's no sequel to this book, called Plus, like Where the Red Fern Grows 2. Wait, what do you say?
Well, I'm just curious to see how they did this when.
So was I.
33, all the dogs are dead. There's no other way to put that.
Yeah. So. Get ready for this, because I was so deathly curious about what the sequel of this book is. And it takes place, I don't remember if it's post-World War I or World War II. One of the big wars. And Billy comes back to live with his grandfather. The grandfather, also played by Wilford Brimley, weird connection there.
His dad's still alive, like, 30 years later?
No, that's the thing, it's his grandfather.
Sorry, his grandfather's still alive, yeah, 30 years later.
Why wouldn't it just be the dad? Excellent point, Dom. I don't know. He comes back from serving in the war, and his grandpa's like, hey, Billy, remember how you loved those dogs and loved raccoon hunting? And he's like, yes. He's like, well, I've got just the thing to cheer you up after being away at war. And he gets him two more dogs, and they just do the raccoon hunting again. And he just has to, and there's literally a scene of him finding the dogs and being like, no, I don't want more dogs. It's horribly acted. And they just do it again, and the dogs die at the end again.
No!
Yes!
Are you kidding me?
I think maybe one does live, actually, now that I say that. I think, for the record, once I saw how bad this was, I started skipping through it, because I was just like, where are we going from here? There's also a subplot about his friend dating his sister, I think. That's not very interesting. But
I'm surprised, because I was pretty sure Billy wanted to date his sisters, honestly.
Oh, yeah. What? Oh, because they're rednecks, I get it.
No, well, he also kept saying things like, my sister brought me lunch out while I was chopping down the giant tree. I could have kissed her, but I didn't.
It was
Billy.
I don't know.
Redneck.
It's the weirdest thing that's happened. And I don't recommend watching it, but maybe just skip through it like I did, because it's freaking bonkers. They're like, well, let's just write a book where the dog. Let's write a movie where the dogs die again.
That's so stupid.
It's so dumb.
But also now he's also a World War I veteran.
He's a veteran of one of the World Wars. I don't know which one.
Well, if he was what, 13 in 1911, and I mean, the Second World War wasn't until 1939, and the Americans didn't get involved until, like, 1941.
Yeah, that's why I feel like it would be World War I, but for some reason in, like, my brain I remember being World War II, because I feel like there had, like, a 50s vibe, but I could be totally wrong. I have to watch this movie by skipping around once, so don't take my word on that. But it's so weird that exists.
That is kind of nuts. Okay, well, anything else you want to wrap up on?
No, I mean, I think we did a pretty good job covering it.
I think so, too.
If you're interested, give it a read, audience. It's a book for children that is simple, but a good time, kind of.
Definitely warning for it being sad, and I hope you guys paid more attention to that than I did.
Yes.
Warning yeah. for...
Heed our warning, unlike Dom.
Yeah. Warning for animal abuse, animal death, animal cruelty, just all sorts of animals. Yeah. It's a book that loves animals, but also has a slightly blasé attitude to pain and suffering, I think. So maybe not blasé, but it's like he's not afraid to punish, you know, the animals die and they get hurt, and it's, you know, just kind of it's tragic. So yeah, mentally prepare yourself for that if that's not
your thing. I don't recommend this book, for the record. Yeah. I know a lot of people that, and I think you may be one of them, where it's like, if the dog dies, I don't want to watch it or read it, or if the animal dies, etc. And so they nope out immediately, and I'm like, I get it. But I think it's a beautiful story, nonetheless.
It is, like, it is beautiful, and it's like, I can't say that I hated it, but I can't say that I would have willingly read it if I'd known in advance what it was about. So
yeah, as you can say through gritted teeth, that there's something to enjoy.
He's a good author. I just think maybe the cat was too far.
Like, that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Indeed. But yes, as my friend Vera would say, Lucas, plug your stuff. Tell me again, what's that podcast
you do? Yeah, yes, a D-Comedy podcast. We already talked about it at the beginning, but we watch and review all the Disney Channel original movies. You can find us on wherever fine podcasts are sold, mostly. And you can find us on Twitter at D-Comedy Podcast. Give us a follow there so you know when new episodes are going up. You can follow me at wildfire_king on Twitter. I will never call it X. I don't tweet that much, honestly. There's not that much. If you're begging for Lucas content, there's not gonna get that much off my Twitter. It's mostly just me retweeting my own podcast, because I'm a shill, as I'm doing right now. Check out audioentropy.com. There's a bunch of great podcasts there. I occasionally guest on Teenagers with Attitude, which is a Power Rangers podcast. They have totally reprised, where they're rewatch a bunch of stuff right now. They're rewatching all of Columbo. And that's all run by my friends who have our own little podcast network, audioentropy.com. There's going to be something on there you like, I bet.
Very nice, very nice. Well, I'll throw some links in the show notes as well. And yeah, if y'all would like to see this or any future podcast, including our very handsome faces, then there is a video version of it available on my Patreon page to all pledge levels. And me and my good buddy Lucas here, almost said your name correctly, are about to head into the VIP room where we're going to talk about life, the universe, and everything, which will be exclusively available on Patreon as well. So,
are there, hopefully I'll see you guys there. Are there strippers in the VIP room?
There's nothing, but the entire room is made of strippers. It's
okay,
very
good. Okay.
Structurally
unsound. I was going to say, because you shouldn't call it that if there's no strippers involved.
I mean, they're all in their 70s, so that's something you're going to have to deal with.
You don't have to sell me on it.
We may cut that bit out.
What? That's a joke.
Well, ending on that little nugget. Peace and love, y'all. See ya.
Let's do it a bit. I don't know if you want me. Bye, everybody. It's a podcast. I'm doing a joke.
It is a podcast.